Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about focus and literally strict focus and compliance of the Constitution. I can't beg you enough to please support Jerry. Jerry Wistrand, he needs your support. We need him in office. I go on and on about this, and I sometimes belabor the point. I don't want to belabor points today, at least none of the usual. But I will belabor this one point, and it kind of stems from this conversation that I just had with Sean before we started today. Folks, any business that creates a vacuum, in other words, when they have the mentality not invented here, in other words, if the direction doesn't come from he on high or, you know, those in control, then you've got a business that is doomed. You've got a business that is working their way into irrelevance. The best businesses, the best organizations, the best teams, and the best leadership is a leadership that thrives on challenges and is open to challenges. And so the fact is that when you actually get involved in this, and I know you, many of you are probably in this situation, you're more than welcome to challenge, to send an email, what have you. I told Sean before we started, I wish we would have recorded that conversation, because he forced me to kind of connect the dots. This isn't complicated. And you know what, Sean, welcome back. Am I marginalizing when I say that this isn't rocket science?
No, sir, you're not.
Okay.
Like the gospel, it's very simple.
But you got to start connecting the dots. And
oh, absolutely. Like a Berean, you have to search the scriptures to see that it's true.
Folks, if there are things that you need, because, as you know, Sean deals with a lot of different people that are in the Patriot Forum that are challenging the legitimacy of our government, such as the sovereign citizens, the general assemblies, those people, we talk about them. They are secessionists. They are not U.S. citizens, and they tell you, in other words, there's a scripture that with their lips they do honor me, but with their heart they have removed themselves far from me. That's exactly how they are regarding the Constitution. They say they love the Constitution, but only this version of it, only this or that. And reality is they don't. The reality is they want to take you back to the Articles of Confederation, to the inept, impotent, where we're doomed and we will be ran over and ruckshod by whatever the next tyrant of the century is that is controlling, you know, some evil empire. Anyway, the point is, and what I don't want to belabor the point, is that I understand that sometimes things just, I say things that may not make it simple, or I may make it simple for me to say it, but it just doesn't click for you. This is why when I have Tammy on, she has different questions. Sean has different questions, and Sean really comes up with some good meaty questions, because he goes off and Googles and does the research and looks and goes, hold on here, what about this and this and this and this and this? And so when we get to those things, because we're going to actually cover some of the stuff that we've talked about as far as states joining the union and so forth. But the point is that if you're not asking, if you're not, you know, driving and coming into, hold on here, what you just said is not making sense because I'm reading this. We have to, you know, I have to understand that when you have an hour, when you're trying to get something into an elevator pitch, there's really no elevator pitch in connecting the dots. You literally have to do that yourself. I can connect the dots. I can throw them out there. I can continually throw them out there. But until you actually connect the dots yourself to where you actually see, because We have to operate that the Constitution, not the Bible, the Constitution for the United States, in other words, those seven articles and all 28 amendments that have been ratified, that is the supreme law of the land. All states must be and must heed and follow and submit to those laws. One of the problems we have is that not one state in the Union is actually following Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. They are not enforcing that every public servant who violates their oath or fails to support the Constitution be removed. We talk about this all the time. It's the honor amongst thieves and so forth and so on. So when you're working in your mind or when you're talking to people and so forth, and you run into a brick wall or you run into something that stumps you, our contact information, my contact information is on the website. Just send me an email. I got a phone number. If you call, make sure you give me your email, because the chance of me being able to call you at a time that would be convenient for you would probably be slim to none. Because when I deal with, and it's not that you're a distraction, when I deal with these types of problems, and not that it's not important, I'm dealing with a lot of other things, family being one of those things, that's really important. So I only get to these questions and so forth at night. You don't want me calling you. If you're on the East Coast, you don't want me calling you in 2 in the morning. I don't think so. I wouldn't think so. So give me your email address. And if it's one of those fancy, spell it out phonetically. So phonetically would be, how would that be, Sean? Phonetically, how do I say Sean or spell Sean? It's spelling it, right?
Sierra Hotel, there you go. Whiskey, November.
There you go. That's how we state it. So give it to me that way if you can. Or some people use the phonetics for the law enforcement. And I think it's Sam, Adam, right? They use the names and or fruits or what have you. Sam, Apple. Anywho, that's all I'm asking, folks. I know you have questions. I know that we go through this in breakneck speed. I know I actually create generalisms that I say that every state is created by the counties. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's actually happened because the federal government is intervened. We're finding, and we knew this, and I point this out in Indiana, that the federal government started intervening. By the time we get to Utah and the western states, this actually speaks to why Wyoming and I think Idaho were the two states that actually snuck under the line. Did you know that, Sean?
No, sir. I was not aware of that.
They did not have enabling acts. They went off and they actually formed, by counties, they formed themselves by using the county model. When you read the Wyoming Constitutional Convention, the county sent delegates on their own because, this guy. So Wyoming had women's suffrage. They wanted to make women's suffrage. They wanted to get into the United States, but they were afraid that because they had women's suffrage that Congress would say, you got to get rid of that. We're not allowing women to vote in our federal elections or anything like that. So they went off and had a convention. They created a constitution. They sent it off and said, please admit us into the union. And they actually injected those things that the federal government would want to see, i.e. they injected that we're an inseparable part of the union, which is unconstitutional for state to state. No state can surrender its sovereignty to a subordinate entity. They can put it in paper, but they can't be held to that because they have this inalienable right as the parent, and they have, I'll just call it a godly right as the parent of something, the ability to hold that child accountable. So it may be an enumeration in the Constitution, but this goes back to the Ninth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and so forth, that states cannot be beholden to an entity that doesn't have the legitimate authority to hold them accountable to that. So anyway, let's dive into the Massachusetts debates. Now, we were just beginning before the show ended. We were dealing with the commerce portion of what day is this? I believe this is the 21st. Yes, it is the 21st of January. And this is Mr. Davies. And so when you find the commerce right under Davies, we just, Sean just read that first paragraph. And so at, I think at that point I said, Sean, do you got, you know, the last 2 minutes are yours, or was that the previous one? I forget. But is there anything we needed to go back on regarding this?
I do not believe so, sir.
Well, one thing, and this is so interesting. When we read these things, they actually start, they talk about and they give us insight of what's going on around the world. And they say here, the great and nourishing empire of China has but little commerce beyond her own territories. Now, I don't know if anybody knew this, that China saw no need to trade with any country. Britain was the first country to truly trade with China, and the trade was giving them opium for their tea, because Britain loved their tea, and China didn't see the evil insidiousness of, you know, using opium. And then when the empire finally, or I should say the emperor, finally discovered that, hey, this stuff is destructive, it's rotting our society, the emperor stood up and said, hey, look, you're going to have to start paying us silver. We can't take opium as payment anymore. It's killing us, literally. And that's when the, I think it was the East Indies Trading Company, whatever the trading company was, I think it was the East Indies Trading Company. They took gunboats. They went up the river, and they just shot up all the townships that were along the river in China. Killed all sorts of people, destroyed everything they could. And they said, are you sure you want us to pay you in silver? Because we think tea is a fair trade. And they continued to trade opium for tea until, you know, China on its own just no longer had a desire for opium. And they said, if you want the tea, we don't want the opium, but if you want the tea, you can pay for silver. It kind of forced that issue. Folks, China learned their ruthlessness from Britain, just so you know. And that right there kind of gives you this insight that China, they were minding their own business when Britain was doing this to them. And this was, that actually happened before this. In other words, Britain was running drugs into China about a century before this. Anyway. All right, sorry for the little side note. Let's go ahead and get into the second paragraph. Go ahead.
But it is not only our coasting trade. Our whole commerce is going to ruin. Congress has not had power to make even a trade law which shall confine the importation of foreign goods to the ships of the producing or consuming country. If we had such a law, we should not go to England for the goods of other nations. Nor would British vessels be the carriers of American produce from our sister states. In the states southward of the Delaware, it is agreed that 3/4 of the produce are exported and 3/4 of the returns are made in British bottoms. It is said that for exporting timber, 1/2 the property goes to the carrier, and of the produce in general, it has been computed that when it is shipped for London from a southern state, to the value of $1,000,000, the British merchant draws from that sum $300,000 under the names of freight and charges. This is money which belongs to the New England states because we can furnish the ships as well as and much better than the British. Our sister states are willing that we should receive these benefits and that they should be secured to us by national laws. But until this is done, their private merchants will, no doubt, for the sake of long credit or some other such temporary advantage, prefer the ships of foreigners. And yet we have suffered these ignominious burdens rather than trust our own representatives with power to help us. And we call ourselves free and independent states. We are independent of each other, but we are slaves to Europe. We have no uniformity in duties, imposts, excises, or prohibitions. Congress has no authority to withhold advantages from foreigners in order to obtain advantages from them. By the 9th of the old articles, Congress may enter into treaties and alliances under certain provisos, but Congress cannot pledge that a single state shall not render the whole Treaty of Commerce a nullity. A nullity.
A nullity. Yes, so interesting, right? I mean, here he's pointing out that under the new union, they can start cooperating where they all benefit, where they no longer, because I learned this a long, long time ago, that, and I started seeing how the shift of commerce started flowing over the last couple hundred years. When we look at this point in time, Britain was running most of the commerce. America started running on its own, but the world wasn't a big buyer of American goods like Britain, because where was Britain's markets? Britain's markets was the world. And so when Britain was moving anything into India, moving anything down into Africa, down into the Mediterranean and what have you, these, you know, Britain was the empire. That this is the point in time where the saying, the sun never sets on Britain, it was alive and well at that point. So it took a long time for the carriers of commerce to slowly shift to where the United States became a predominant carrier. We never monopolized. And that's for the most part because we weren't out to do that. We were only protecting ourselves, nationalism kind of thing. And which left it kind of open for somebody to do it cheaper. So eventually, and as we see probably towards the 70s, a new force in moving world commerce. And guess who that new force was? Got any ideas?
Us.
They're right now, the majority of commerce that flows on the seas is controlled by what country? Look it up.
Well, I was looking at this the other day.
And when you actually look it up, you'll realize that who has who has grown in market share in trading and having a control over trade with most countries in the world, because this country has been very aggressive in trying to root out America and basically giving themselves the edge so that they're carrying their own products in and out of these countries, back to themselves, and so forth. So when you do that, when you're doing that, that means that everything's riding on your ships.
Switzerland.
Switzerland is the nation's largest carrier of ships. I don't even think that if you parked all the ships, there would be room to park all the ships of the world in Switzerland water. It's the, right. I believe it's China. Mako,
Well, we have Switzerland, Denmark, France, China, Germany.
Really? As far as the ownership of the commerce companies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Top five carriers.
Okay. So China wasn't even a blip, because remember what it just said here is they didn't even care about it. Now look at them. And they are driving all the commerce that they take anywhere through Africa, the Middle East, and so forth. It's riding on their ships. And we've seen this just lately in the news with the Hormuz and so forth. Anyway, okay, so just finding that interesting. But the point is very clear that the Constitution was going to give the states a huge benefit. A huge benefit. All right, so let's go down to the convention. This little tag we have here for the convention under General Thompson.
Mr. President, I totally abhor this paragraph. Massachusetts has ever been a leading state. Now let her give good advice to her sister states. Suppose 9 states adopt this constitution. Who shall touch the other 4? Some cry out, force them. I say, draw them. We love liberty. Britain never tried to enslave us until she told us we had too much liberty. The Confederation wants amendments. Shall we not amend it? The convention were sent on to Philadelphia to amend this Confederation, but they made a new creature, and the very setting out of it is unconstitutional. In the convention, Pennsylvania had more members than all New England, and two of our delegates only were persuaded to sign the Constitution. Massachusetts once shut up the harbors against the British. There, I confess, I was taken in. Don't let us be in a hurry again. Let us wait to see what our sister states will do. What shall we suffer if we adjourn the consideration of it for 5 or 6 months? It is better to do this than adopt it so hastily. Take care we don't disunite the states. By uniting we stand, by dividing we fall.
Ah, so he's kind of speaking out a little bit of both sides of his mouth here, but he's making the point that Britain didn't force anybody into it. And he's saying that there are people that are saying, we're going to force these other states into it. And actually, that was never the case. North Carolina didn't join the Union. There was no pressure placed upon North Carolina in 1789 when Congress was convening. North Carolina was on their own. And at that point in time, if North Carolina and Rhode Island wanted to maintain Continental Congress, they could have actually convened and maintained Continental Congress, because Continental Congress was still in play. They just couldn't meet in Pennsylvania anymore. They would either have to meet in Rhode Island or in North Carolina. Does that make sense? Because Pennsylvania joined the Union. So as we look at how things were unfolding, I think that there was some hyperbole where people talked about we could do this pressure, and there has been state assertions that Rhode Island was basically forced or coerced into, and I don't believe that was the case at all. I believe that what ended up happening with Rhode Island, and, you know, if it's hard to get real accurate truth on some of these things. There is evidence that there were affluent people in Rhode Island that wanted to be in the Union because they wanted the benefits of this trade. In other words, those people who had big businesses, those people who had the best opportunity of benefiting, they were the ones that were driving and creating, I would say, the hyperbole. They were the ones that had the motivation or... Yeah, I would just say that motivation and convincing people are one way or the other, hook or crook, right? So in other words, you know, they either scare them or they entice them, you know, or the, let's call it the carrot and the stick, you know, entice them with a reward to say, well, if we do this, we can do these things. And, or if we don't do this, we're going to beat you with a stick. So they were the ones that had the most to gain and the most to lose. Therefore, I think that if you do the research, you'll probably find that there was really no external animosity and hatred or, you know, routing or guns and blazing. There was nothing like that happening, because these were pretty civil men. They believed in civil discourse and to resolve problems, as men in ideological space or in dialogue, not with fisticuffs and that type of thing. This is a time when the shift of society was moving away from the duel and moving more towards a civil discourse, debate, and so forth. Anyway, let's dive into the delegated powers on the next day, January 2nd, under Judge Sumner.
The powers proposed to be delegated in this section are very important, as they will, in effect, place the purse strings of the citizens.
Ah, hold on, Sean. I apologize. I should have looked at that as I started looking ahead of this, and then I noticed, we're out of time. So let's just take this up after the break, because this is a short one, but we need to pick this up after the break. My apologies again. Folks, we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so before that hard break rudely interrupted us, let's pick that up again. Thank you.
The powers proposed to be delegated in this section are very important, as they will, in effect, place the purse strings of the citizens in the hands of Congress for certain purposes. In order to know whether such powers are necessary, we ought, sir, to inquire what the design of uniting under one government is. It is that the national dignity may be supported, its safety preserved, and necessary debts paid. Is it not necessary then to afford the means by which alone those objects can be attained? Much better, it appears to me, would it be for the states not to unite under one government, which will be attended with some expense, than to unite and at the same time withhold the powers necessary to accomplish the design of the union? Gentlemen say the power to raise money may be abused. I grant it, and the same may be said of any other delegated power. Our general court had the same power, but did they ever dare abuse it? Instead of voting themselves six, I'm not sure what that means.
Six shillings, I think, and $8, whatever.
Okay, six shillings and $8. They might vote themselves 12 pounds a day. Uh-huh. But there never was a complaint of their voting themselves more than what was reasonable. Mm-hmm. If they should make an undue use of their power, they know a loss of confidence in the people would be the consequence, mm-hmm. and they would not be reelected. And this is one security in the hands of the people.
Actually, I think that was 8 pennies, 6 shillings and 8 pennies.
Okay.
They might vote themselves 12 pounds a day, right. Which, I mean, obviously the 6 shillings, I don't even think, equated to a pound. The point is that he's actually saying something that's going to be repeated over and over and over again, that the powers in this Constitution can be abused. The powers in the Articles of Confederation can be abused. Powers can be abused. Who can argue that? What is the mechanism of holding them? So this is where later on they actually start getting into, well, what do we do when they do abuse those powers? What is our recourse? And that's when in Virginia they actually talk about interposition, or basically standing up and saying, the states rising to the occasion and saying, you don't have the power to do this. That they have the authority and the power, because where is the army at that point in time? It's in the state's hands, because the militia has not been called up by the federal government. The militia is in the hands of the state. So the states actually have the authority to use that type of force, but they should never need to. Why? Because the representatives in Congress still have to come home. They were not creating an aristocracy where all of a sudden these guys no longer were residents of their homes. They were representatives, and they needed those people back at that state to elect them again. So there were all these different processes that they started identifying as methods of keeping government in control and check. The real problem was that when the federal government formed, who went? Well, easy. The best and the brightest. In other words, the state sent those men that they were proud of the most because that's who they elected. The best men were the ones that won. Ergo, when they sent their best men into the federal government, it would have been an insult to their integrity and honor to challenge them or to think that they weren't doing what they should be doing. Do you see the problem?
Yeah, trust in man.
They're over trust.
Instead of the law.
Correct. And instead of basically saying, and what should have really happened, and this is where I talk to party leadership to say, every Republican needs to report every measure that they vote on and how they voted and why. They need to be held accountable. It's not about holding accountable. It's about reporting. You're out representing us. What did you do and why did you do it? Because if you're not doing that, if you're not demanding them provide you that information, then you're letting them run roughshod over you. Anyway, let's go.
I think they should wear body cams.
You know what? I think I actually put that in my book, one of my very first books, that as long as they're out in the public forum, in other words, when they walk out of their home at the beginning of the day and when they, you know, go back home at the end of the day, that's when they turn the camera on and turn the camera off, that, you know, the microphone, everything goes off. However, any communication going into that home and coming out of that home to external entities must be monitored because, obviously, lobbyists can call them at home. We cannot allow, in other words, if we demand full transparency. But here's the real question. I believe that even that paradigm, because I changed that paradigm and I shifted it, because a lobbyist has no right to contact your representative unless that lobbyist actually happens to reside and is operating and is an integral part of the constituency and the base of that district that he's representing or that that county, that state.
Representation.
Right. In other words, you know, these people that come with money, they just don't have a right to come up and talk to your folks. Your representatives, if we're a Republican form of government, the only people that should have access to them are their constituents. That's it. And or people, let's just say you have, you know, Senator Kennedy, who's on a committee that is overseeing a bunch of these different contracts or what have you. And there's lobbyists or people from the companies coming in, reporting on the progress of the execution of the contract. I mean, that's permissible because it's in the execution of the duties of the senator to find out, you know, how this is going, how's the proposal on that type of thing. But when somebody comes along and says, hey, we got a bill we'd like you to consider voting for. Absolutely not. Right.
And I see a problem with the advocacy, like they always say, oh, I'm going to get stuff for my state. I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to make sure the people of Kentucky or Louisiana or whatever get this and get that. And they're all lobbying for these pet projects that are going to help their state when they're supposed to be running the business of the union.
Well, that's
and those delegated authorities within a union, not with favoritism towards their state.
That's really not a problem, though. The question is that issue that's going to bring money to their state within the enumerated objects? If it's not within the enumerated objects, then they're operating outside their powers.
Correct.
There goes their ability to even be involved in those things unless they amend the Constitution to be able to do those things. So, anyway, let's go to the next one, which is welfare. Under the Honorable Mr. Phillips of, what? Boston.
I rise to make a few observations on this section, as it contains powers absolutely necessary. If social government did not exist, there would be an end of individual government. Therefore, our very being depends on social government. On this article is founded the main pillar of the building. Take away this pillar, and where is your government? Therefore, I conceive, in this view of the case, this power is absolutely necessary. There seems to be a suspicion that this power will be abused. But is not all delegation of power equally dangerous? If we have a castle, shall we delay to put a commander into it for fear he would turn his artillery against us? My concern is for the majesty of the people. If there is no virtue among them, what will the Congress do? If they had the meekness of Moses, the patience of Job, and the wisdom of Solomon, and the people were determined to be slaves, sir, could the Congress prevent them? If they set heaven at defiance, no arm of flesh can save them. Sir, I still have nothing to do in this government, but we see the situation we are in. We are verging toward destruction, and everyone must be sensible of it. I suppose New England states have a treasure offered to them better than the mines of Peru, and it cannot be to the disadvantage of the southern states. Great Britain and France come here with their vessels, instead of our carrying our produce to those countries in American vessels navigated by our citizens. When I consider the extensive seacoast there is to this state alone, so well calculated for commerce, viewing matters in this light, I would rather sink all this continent owed me than this power should be withheld from Congress. Mention is made that Congress ought to be restricted of the power to keep an army except in time of war. I apprehend that great mischief would ensue from such a restriction. Let us take means to prevent war by granting to Congress the power of raising an army. If a declaration of war is made against this country and the enemy's army is coming against us, before Congress could collect the means to withstand this enemy, they would penetrate into the bowels of our country, and everything dear to us would be gone in a moment. The honorable gentleman from Topsham has made use of the expression, "Oh, my country," from an apprehension that the Constitution should be adopted. I will cry out, "Oh, my country," if it is not adopted. I see nothing but destruction and inevitable ruin if it is not. The more I peruse and study this article, the more convinced am I of the necessity of such a power being vested in Congress. The more I hear said against it, the more I am confirmed in my sentiments of its expediency. For it is like the pure metal. The more you rub it, the brighter it shines. It is with concern I hear the honorable gentleman from Topsham make use of language against the gentleman of the law. Sir, I look on this order of men to be essential to the liberties and rights of the people, and whoever speaks against them as speaking against an ordinance of heaven. Mr. President, I hope every gentleman will offer his sentiments candidly on this momentous affair, that he will examine for himself and consider that he is not only the good of his commonwealth under consideration, but the welfare of the United States.
So, when they were arguing against the standing army, when they were arguing for the standing army, either way, the standing army really wasn't necessary because every state held the obligation, and it's actually, you find it in Article 1, Section 10, even though it's a restriction placed upon the state, it's in Subsection 3. It says, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in peacetime, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with foreign powers, or engage in war, and here's the kicker, unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. So in other words, when the states are being invaded, they have the right to use their militia to protect them. Whether they maintain a militia, where the militia by the Constitution is being trained, being disciplined. In other words, the militia isn't just something that sits on the shelf until, you know what, we think we need to do this. No. Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15 basically states that the federal government will provide for, in other words, pay the money to keep, equip, train, and maintain discipline amongst the state militias so that when the time comes to be called, they will be ready. So you see these arguments, and I'm going, okay, they haven't gotten to the next one. The other foot hasn't dropped yet, or what have you. So anyway, let's dive down to the guns. Now, this is more of an anti-federalist, because that's what the AF stands for. This is more of an anti-federalist comment. Go ahead.
Dr. Willard entered largely into the field of ancient history and deduced therefrom arguments to prove that where power had been trusted to men, whether in great or small bodies, they had always abused it, and thus republics had soon degenerated into aristocracies. He instanced Sparta, Athens, and Rome. The Amphictyonic League, he said, resembled the Confederation of the United States. While thus united, they defeated Xerxes, but were subdued by the gold of Philip, who brought the council to betray the interests of their country. Very prophetic.
Yes, go ahead to the next one, because that's still...
Honorable Mr. Gorham, mm-hmm. in reply to the gentleman from Uxbridge, exposed the absurdity of conclusions and hypotheses drawn from ancient governments, which bore no relation to the Confederacy proposed. For those governments had no idea of representations as we have. He, however, warned us against the evil which had ruined those states, which he thought was the want of an efficient federal government. As much as the Athenians rejoiced in the extirpation of a Lacedaemonian will, if we are disunited, a citizen of Massachusetts at the death of a Connecticut man or a Yorker. With respect to the proposed government degenerating into an aristocracy, the honorable gentleman observed that the nature and situation of our country rendered such a circumstance impossible, as from the great preponderance of the agricultural interest in the United States, that interest would always have in its power to elect such men as would, he observed, effectually prevent the introduction of any other than a perfectly democratical form of government.
Okay. And that wasn't a bad thing in those days.
Right.
Okay. So now
it's funny to me how he talks about those things devolving into aristocracy, and that's basically what we have now, the aristocracy of the parties.
Okay, so that's because we the people believe that if they can get the numbers necessary to pass a bill, that they can do it. We don't say, hey, where in the Constitution do you have the power to even make that type of law? We fail to challenge them. We've allowed them to act and become our royalty. They are above the law because we fail to hold them accountable. So are we surprised we have an aristocracy? Well, they're behaving like one because we allow that.
Because we're acting like peasants.
Or we believe that they actually have these unlimited powers because we haven't been taught that we have enumerated constitutions, that they don't have general powers, because nobody reads the Constitution. Our illiteracy on the Constitution is what's killing us. Now we can get into the guns and the anti-federalist comment by Mr. Simes.
Guns AF, okay.
Uh-huh.
I humbly submit it, sir, whether if each state had its proportion of some certain gross sum assigned according to its numbers and a power was given to Congress to collect the same, in case of a default in the state, this would not have been a safer constitution. For, sir, I also disapprove of the power to collect, which is here vested in Congress. It is a power, sir, to burden us with a standing army of ravenous collectors, harpies, perhaps, from another state, but who, however, were known to have bowels for any purpose but to fatten on the lifeblood of the people. In an age or two, this will be the case, and when the Congress shall become tyrannical, these vultures, their servants, will be the tyrants of the village, by whose presence all freedom of speech and action will be taken away. Another prophet.
Yeah, so when did the federal government actually start creating this tyrannical army of tax collection?
I do not know. 1913, well, probably?
Yeah, but what did he say here? That he says, harpies and every purpose of lifeblood. In an age or two, this will be the case. Right? So what's an age? 20, 30 years? Yeah, generate 20, 30 years. Okay. Yeah. 40 tops, maybe. So, I mean, it went well beyond that before. And the only reason that the 16th Amendment created the IRS was because everybody forgot the Whiskey Rebellion. Everybody forgot that it was the militia to enforce it. The 16th Amendment did not authorize Congress to create the enforcement agency. It said that they have the power to execute this law by legislation. In other words, they had the, if I open up, excuse me, if I open up the 16th Amendment, which I got right here, and actually I think I still have it over here, don't I? No. So the 16th Amendment, right here, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source then derived without apportionment among the states and without any regard to any census or enumeration. Do you see anywhere in there where they have the authority to create an enforcement entity to support this? No. So what is the enforcement of enforcing federal law? Well, Congress has the power to call forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union. Okay, so when they need to, they will call forth them. And did they need to every time they created a tax? No. It was only when the states decided not to comply to the legitimate federal law, i.e. the whiskey tax. I don't think after that there was ever any pushback to say you can't create this tax. For the most part, they hash it out. Yeah, they have the authority. We're going to have to pay this tax. And that's how it went. So the fact that they even created the IRS wasn't because they had the legitimate authority. Nobody knew to challenge them. Nobody stood up and said, hey, you know what? You don't have that authority. So why are you doing that? Anyway, okay, so.
Because that's basically a standing army, if you think about it.
They are. Every enforcement agency created, the ATF, the Forestry Service, anybody that is out there that is paid to maintain the regulations of the federal government, Food and Drug Administration, these are all standing armies. Absolutely. Every single one of them. Okay, so now we have Mr. Jones of Boston starts talking about corporations.
Enlarged on the various checks which the Constitution provides and which, he said, formed a security for liberty and prevention against power being abused, the frequency of elections of the democratic branch, representation apportioned to numbers, the publication of the journals of Congress, etc. Gentlemen, he said, had compared the people of this country to those of Rome. But, he observed, the comparison was very erroneous. The Romans were divided into two classes, the nobility and the plebeians. The nobility kept all kinds of knowledge to their own class, and the plebeians were, in general, very ignorant, and when unemployed in time of peace, were ever ready for revolt and to follow the dictates of any designing patrician. But, continued the worthy gentleman, the people of the United States are an enlightened, well-informed people and are therefore not easily imposed on by designing men. Our right of representation, concluded Mr. J., is much more just and equitable than the boasted one of Great Britain, whose representatives are chosen by corporations or boroughs, and those boroughs in general are the property or at the disposal of the nobility and rich gentry of the kingdom.
So I'm not sure if I said this lately, but I think I've mentioned this, that Parliament was actually an aristocracy. Parliament, the people who were representing the people in the House of Commons were these people who were literally controlling these corporations, these boroughs, and so forth. They had their own nobility down in the House of Commons. And the nobility, of the control of that nobility, also was literally in the step above them. In other words, the same class of people controlled both layers of nobility, the aristocracies, i.e. the House of Lords was literally an appointment by, and they were the aristocrats. The people down below may not have been actual aristocrats, but they were representing the aristocrats. Does that make sense?
Were they more like merchant class or those kind of people?
Yeah, I mean, they were people that were funded and supported.
The rich guys, not necessarily nobility.
All they needed to be was willing to do the bidding, because you know the he who pays the piper pays the calls the tune. These guys were being on the take. They were on the take. The corporations and the boroughs where they had amassed money and influence, they were able to control these people. And so they were
kind of like the pharmaceutical industry today has their guys that represent them in Congress.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. That's why we look and we say, they're controlled. Our House of Representatives is controlled by an aristocracy. They've created their own tone of an aristocracy because they've created.
Would it be an oligarchy?
Well, so an oligarchy is really more of a smaller class or smaller group of people.
Right. Okay.
But an aristocracy is where a class of people, it's almost like a caste system where the law isn't applied to them or they're above the law. That's a typical aristocracy or caste system, right? In America, we had a caste system. We had the blacks that were slaves and the whites that weren't. And in our politics, we had politicians that were not immune to the law. And they're actually going to cover this. This is the one state that actually mentions, hey, these guys are not immune to the laws they pass. They have to live under the same laws that they pass. That's provided as a stipulation and a clarification that these people could not immune themselves from their own laws. And yet they do.
Why? I was going to say, and yet.
Right. And why? Because we stopped reading the ratification debates. And we started reading the Federalist Papers. Because the Federalist Papers didn't cover this type of stuff. And so we're running out of time. A great show. I appreciate the help. And this was a good note to go out on, because this actually kind of hits that tone. You know, folks, it is the ratification debates that clearly define what our government can do and what they can't do. The federal courts and bureaucrats, executives, they have no authority to redefine what that Constitution means and what they can do and what they can't do. The only way that they can change that is by amending the Constitution and redefining to give them or grant them the ability to do something different than as defined. So, with that being said, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless, and we'll see you tomorrow. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.